So it is Wednesday. My name is Tom Scott. I'm chairman of the Nantucket Project, joined as always by R. Pietti. I'm about to remove my mask. I just wanted to explain why. I am inside Memphis Rocks, and I'm with Tom Shadyac. And Tom and I are 20 feet apart. We're a ways away from each other. We're trying to be safe, and we've been wearing our masks all morning. I just wanted to share that. I'm going to do a little intro. I took a couple pictures. I'm in Memphis visiting Tom Shadyac, amongst other things. And Tom, what I would say is that, you know, it's one of those mornings where I kind of don't know what I'm getting myself into, and I show up and there's so much input. There's so much I was taking in this morning. And I want to just give a, you know, a little highlight on what that is. And I'm obviously, I want you to talk a lot about it today, but I feel like just as like, if this was our establishing shot, I kind of want to do just a quick establishing shot. But before we do, I know you, Tom and RP, have met each other at a minimum because you've been in the same shows together, but I don't know if you've actually met each other. So I want to make sure you guys say hi to each other if you have not met. Have you met? I don't even know.
I think we may have met at TMP briefingly, but like all the people who want to meet the celebrity, I was yet another fawning person in your circle. So here I am now looking at your video.
I certainly know you, and I've been edified and educated every time I hear your expertise. So it's great to make it personal.
It's nice of you to say.
Yes, so Tom Shadyac, I'm sitting next to the Juice Almighty, which is his juice bar, and that obviously is derived, or maybe not obviously derived, from Bruce Almighty. Tom's made a lot of films. Liar, Liar. There's all kinds of films that Tom has made. Very successful film producer, film director, film writer. And, you know, now Tom, among other things, runs this organization that we're at today. We had hoped to come out from you outside. We were having some tech difficulties. It was also quite hot. We were sweating a bit. But we're right across from Stax Records. And I'm just going to give us just a little quick tour about how we sort of came here. And it'll give you a sense of where we are. So as you can see, we are literally feet from Soulsville, USA, and Soulsville, USA, this sign in this space is attached to this. This is Stax Records. Stax Records is right across the street. This is a Memphis institution. Memphis is a music town. Tom, any other highlights? I mean, you ended up setting up shop right across the street.
I'd say one exception to what you said. It's not, Memphis is not only a music town, it's a soul town. The soul here is deep, and it's deep because the wounds are deep. And when you understand the wounding and the problems that it's faced, you also understand the promise that it can and soon, I hope, will realize.
Well, you're a big part of the community down here, and I, you know, I kind of knew that before. I've gotten a sense, and whatever big means, I'll define it the way from my observation, which is that you're very close to a lot of the people out here. Are the people down here and the community you built is, it's very evident how sort of powerful it is. So this is Tom's building. We were set up actually right out here. And we are inside Tom's building. That's Chris, who I met a while back up in New York, actually. And Chris is one of Tom's right hands down here. And Memphis Rocks on a regular basis is, you know, this would be crowded with kids today. Obviously, the COVID situation has changed this place, and I just want to point out a couple things that we saw this morning. I mean, one is you guys are serving food. There's people lining up outside right now who are coming in for food, and they're also distributing and creating bottles of hand sanitizer for the community. And if you were watching yesterday, you know, you might see a similar theme here, which is that you know, Tom and his organization say 8 weeks ago was one thing, and 8 weeks later it's a different thing. And that's out of need. And it very much relates, I think, thematically to, again, what we discussed yesterday, which was about putting people first. And Tom, it's a common line. You know, you hear put people first quite a bit. This woman, Stacy, we were with yesterday, who runs a YWCA and sort of it's called Tri-State, but it's near Pottstown, Pennsylvania. You know, among her constituents, you know, there are kids who haven't been in school for 2 months. So they were closed for 2 months. So you can imagine what that does to families, food, education, and on and on and on. And she's transformed her YWCA into a whole variety of things, including a commissary to, you know, to distribute food and to provide care and to do so many things. And the amount of work that she's put in over that period of time has been intense. But that, you know, I believe her when she says it. just as a way to dive in today, Tom, when we were talking about, I had mentioned some of the meetings that I've been a part of through Zoom, largely in the last little bit. And, you know, some of them are community folks like, you know, you are, and a lot of the people I've met today. And then others that we've been a part of are sort of bigger business people, let's say. And one of the comments I made was that, you know, they all seem to have this posture of they're not sure exactly what to do. And when you look for this center, and I don't know, how would I specifically define it? I'm not sure. How would I generally define it? Is that people who are on a mission, who are putting people first, right? Again, that's the line I would use yesterday. I'd be interested to see how you would put that. You feel it. You feel the purpose. You see the outcome. And I mentioned that because a lot of our conversation that we had this morning, Tom, was about where does it go from here? And what is the right answer? And where are we imbalanced? I'm going to ask one more thing, Tom, before you comment on what I was going to say. And that is that I said to Tom, and I've said it to others, we had a business gathering at the Nantucket Project last fall, and Tom was there. And I think it's safe to say, and I don't think Tom would either feel uncomfortable with this or maybe disagree with this, is that you're sort of the outlier in that meeting. From the way you look, from the things you say, right? It's not, that's true. But what I said to him, and I meant it then, and I just want to reemphasize it now, is that some of the things he said that day rang so true to me. But among the challenges of them ringing so true is that they sound a little wacky. They sound a little out there. I'm wondering if maybe they sound a little less wacky and a little less out there now. And so I would just ask us to sort of come in with that, a spirit of like that, you know, where is truth? When truth is in the midst of a known untruth, well, it sounds crazy. When it's exhibited in a thing closer to truth, it starts to sound more true. I'm curious how you react to that or anything else in my verbose introduction you may have to say.
First of all, thanks for coming, man. I'm glad you're here. I'm an outlier in a lot of meetings, so I don't take it as anything but accurate. If I was to use an analogy, a fish swimming in water, and one of those fish finally decides, like, I've got some fins, maybe I'm going to explore what's out of this water, and comes back and tells a story of this whole world that exists, every fish in that water is going to think he's crazy. And I feel like that's a bit of what I represent. I've looked out of the water that we're all swimming in as a culture, and I see these same problems coming out of that water. There's a poison, a toxicity in this water. And I've poked my head out, which I believe the mystics and the saints and the sages, the Gandhis and the Jesus and the Martin Luther Kings and the Mother Teresa's have done. And there's a whole other way to organize this world. And this gym, I hope, is one imperfect iteration of how to organize this world. So there's a saying we have now, very popular on every show. We're all in this together, right? And it's true. Right now, we're all in it together because we can all feel that one person unhealthy in any community might mean my kids are unhealthy in my community. We're very connected right now. But I would like to add one thing, because this is what the current paradigm adds. We're all in this together for now. For now. Because once this passes, we're going to be against each other again. I'm going to be able to put my greedy hat on because my society teaches me, take everything you can. We'll call you a success. Again, that's part of the paradigm that I think we have to look at, rethink, and then build a society based on something more holistic. I'll say one more thing. You can edit the heck out of this. This keeps happening because our system right now is built on an ideology that is not meant to keep us all together. We're not really in it all together. So our structures fall apart when crisis happens. If we built a society where we were really in it all together, we really valued everyone, we treated everyone, including nature, like family, our systems wouldn't fall apart now, they would come to fruition now. But we have to rethink and reinvent whenever there's a crisis like this, because the systems that we've built based on the morality that we are each walking with, they've pitted us against each other, separate from each other, able to take advantage of each other, not just make a living off of each other, but make a killing off of each other. And so we have what we have. And again, I wanted to represent one iteration of a community that is seeing the world differently, like a family, like a brotherhood, and maybe as a point, a spark for other families, other communities in the future to move in a similar direction.
Yeah. So the you know, the journey we've taken down the river, you know, and in fairness, when we were driving out, we stopped in Wheeling, West Virginia. We were outside of Columbus, Ohio. You know, it's more than the river, but we, you know, the formal part of the trip, we started at the, you know, the source of the Mississippi. And as we've come down the Mississippi, we've been in a variety of cities, which, you know, I think it's safe to say Trump probably won just about every city we've come through so far, just about. And I would guess that where we are in Memphis right now, he wouldn't win in this neck of the woods. It's a different kind of thinker, let's say, or, you know, it's a different side of that argument. However, and it looks a little different. You know, not drastically, but there's parts of it that sort of to the eye look a little bit different than some of the cities we've come through. However, I do want to say that there is a common theme of there were problems before this. This is heightening those problems. There's a sense amongst just about everyone we've come across, and I'm generalizing, where they're forgotten, where they don't believe that the systems work for them. They're a little bit angry, maybe a lot of bit angry, or maybe hurt. I mean, there's both of those things that are in there. It's hard for me as I observe that and sort of, you know, consider as best I can in a short period of time, because to be clear, I'm not spending weeks here and breaking out doing interviews day and night. I'm observing as I can. It's difficult for me to look at either side of the extreme side, say the person who's super into Trump, the person who's super against Trump, and see the situations as very different. Or feel any less sympathetic to either side of that equation. Yeah, there's different factors at play in different situations for sure, but the themes are relatively consistent, and the feelings and the emotions and the fears and the frustrations, again, seem to be relatively consistent. Can you, Tom, talk a little bit about, you know, from place to place, there's been a pretty stark difference between the way people view the disease itself. You know, a bunch of the places we've been, it's silly. It's a myth. It's people are overreacting. And so because of that, there's this different kind of anger, which is kind of like you're destroying our economy for nothing. I kind of get the sense here it's not like that. My observation is that people are actually taking the disease pretty seriously. I've seen a lot of masks in this neck of the woods. How do you sort of observe Memphis in the way they're sort of treating this conflict between the disease and the economy and those issues?
Well, first of all, the sort of surface level of it is this is a very vulnerable community. When you look at the statistics now and you realize the higher percentages of people of color that are dying and being infected, and you come to a neighborhood like this and you understand why. Number one, they're the frontline workers. They are the nurses. They are stocking the shelves. They are delivering the goods and the pizzas and the dinners, etc. Number two, they gather. Right, we may have the luxury of staying at home and getting a meal at home alone, and we can keep each other safe. They don't have that luxury. They gather in communities. Community has always been their strength. So if one person in a family is infected, of course, the nieces, the nephews, the grandparents, the grandkids are affected. But that's how they have learned to survive, because not everyone has resources. So you go to the grandparents' house, you go to the house where there are resources, and that strength has become a weakness in this community. But then you take it down to health outcomes, and you go to obesity, diabetes, hypertension, all rampant in this neighborhood. And again, not because these people have been unhealthy, but because they have been birthed into an unhealthy vision of this country and the world. And they are an outgrowth, again, of our philosophy that they were expendable, first through slavery, then through discrimination, segregation, et cetera. And those sins are still amongst us, and they reveal themselves at times like this. So I don't know if I got that question answered, but we're taking it very seriously because we are always listening to our community, and our community is vulnerable. That's why we wear masks. Whatever we do, we wear double layer masks. And when we open this gym, if we open this gym, we will take every precaution possible, because our job is to listen to this community and react to what they need. You said that I'm deeply in the community. The community is also deeply in me. And it has grown me as a human being. I've learned so much about my responsibility to be in relationship with people that I normally would have ignored, or felt something on the news for 5 minutes and then just gone on with my life. I believe I have a responsibility to be in relationship with a neighborhood like this, to listen to them, to see how the country and the world that I benefited from didn't do so well for them. And what is now my role in doing my small part to even the scales of justice by, again, listening and relationship.
So, you know, when I go on, I have tangents, and when I do, I always have this thought of like, what's RP thinking as I wander down this path? And as I wander down this river, RP, and you know, we're now in the South, you know, we started certainly what you would think of. I mean, it's all kind of the Midwest, I guess, to a certain extent, although I think we're more in the South now than we are in the Midwest. You know, you're seeing some cultural changes, but you're seeing some similar themes. And just, I'm curious, RP, how do you react to where we are and what Tom and I have been talking about, and jump in.
I want to ask him a question too, if you give me the grace, like after he answers yours.
That might be helpful, because there's so much that you guys have just discussed, and I wouldn't have any idea where to kind of enter into it. But Tom Shidiak, congratulations on all you've done there, and thank you for doing all that. And Tom Scott, hello. I'm thinking a lot right now about trust, about toxicity, about a leadership vacuum, which we've talked a lot about, which is an area that's a place I can go to relatively comfortably, right? So again, trust, leadership vacuum, toxicity, what's going on there? And then I'm trying to think about what we learned from Stacy yesterday, who is a leader inside, a leader of color inside a predominantly Black neighborhood that's just already been crushed and getting even more crushed. And then Tom Shidiak, listening to where you're working and what you're doing and the lessons you're having. And so what I'm trying to figure out are, at the national level, it's pretty obvious to me that, you know, public health in an epidemic or a pandemic, the oxygen to the solution is trust. Like, that's a fact. And we don't have that. So instead we have, because we have a leadership vacuum, another fact, the leadership vacuum leads to actual material constraints, right? Meaning the federal government leadership vacuum right now, the president's decision that he does not want to be the leader of this response, leads to actual material constraints, because the federal government was designated really the responder in a situation like this. And if they decide not to take that role, then the states all of a sudden have to create capabilities they don't have. So that's like a fact. But the other problem with that leadership vacuum is we don't know what we're arguing for or against. And we end up having thousands of other millions and millions of other arguments that are amplified by the toxicity. So what am I talking about? If we were talking about Tom's climbing gym, and the question was, hey, look, Shadyac, the boss, thinks that all the climbing grips behind him should be one color. He thinks that's really important to his aesthetic. And someone else said, no, they should be multicolored. We'd know what we're arguing about. We'd have a pretty clear definition of the argument. We could really hate each other on other sides of it, but we'd know what we're arguing about. We don't have a clear line of argument now. We talked a couple days ago about the professor from Stanford, who's now being bandied about as like the voice of the right, the voice who's telling us that the president and all the public health officials are wrong. Look what he's saying. In fact, that's not what he's saying at all. What he's saying is probably very similar to what Fauci's saying, which is very similar to what Admiral Ken Bernard is saying, which is very similar to what I would say, not holding myself at that level, but like, you know, the reasonable response. It's not actually a divisive point of view. What we don't know, the binary, the A and the B of our argument. So that's sort of what I'm thinking about. And leadership vacuum just amplifies that. And then the toxicity, of course, spreads it. Let me make one more comment, sorry. Tom, it was coincidental and we didn't catch it, but yesterday, 2 days ago, you were in Missouri and you said people in Missouri were looking at you like you had two heads because you had a mask on. And then we kind of discovered together that, and conversely, I was on the phone with Hong Kong later that day, and someone made the point that they saw someone on the street without a mask on and they thought people were yelling at him, the expression was, it looked like they were walking around naked without any clothes on. So very different responses. In Hong Kong, you look like you're a crazy person without a mask on. In Missouri, you look like you're a crazy person with a mask on. It's the same disease in both places, right? To be fair. But then we discovered the difference is in Hong Kong, they have the sense memory. They've been there. They went through SARS. They've gone through Corona in a way that Missouri hasn't. And inside Missouri, a third of the cases probably were in elder care facilities. And then another third of the national cases were in New York, meaning what was left in Missouri was a small number of cases. What am I getting to? What's Missouri called? Anyone remember? It's the show me state. Show me. I haven't seen it. I got 500 deaths in Missouri. Probably half of them aren't in an elder care facility. You're shutting down all my businesses? Show me. So that's not toxicity. That's debate. Right? So you start with legitimate show me state questions and you work your way down through this muddying of goals because no leadership, leadership vacuum, and then the real disagreements of life versus livelihood. And then you get into partisan greed and goals. These are levels of toxicity, right? You get to commercial greed, which you were talking about, Tom Shadyac. And then you finally end up with true enemies, creators of toxicity inside our debate. And that would be the splinter groups, the neo-Nazis and others who were storming up Capitol steps, Russia and China trying to screw with us. Those are levels of toxicity. More than half of that is within our own control of the leadership vacuum. So, sorry, that's a bit of a tease, but that's what I'm thinking about listening to you talk. And then you asked Stacy yesterday, and Tom, I think you've said the same thing, and you have a different position on this comment. Like, what does that community think about what's going on right now? And what do they think about the fact that about double of the deaths per capita are black versus white? And Stacy said, we think you don't care about us. And that was like a heavy moment for me. So anyway, if you don't let me talk for 30 minutes, then I talk for 20. Sorry. There you go.
Tom, is that the sense you feel here too? That people don't?
Yeah, it's not something that's unusual for them. It's something that's been rooted in their history. I remember when Donald Trump won, and I knew that I had a sense that it would be maybe even traumatic for some of my students at the college across the street, the historical Black college. So I went in, I was somber, and you know, look, I'm not here to point a finger and call anybody, you know, a name, but I think it's, you know, in the ether that we're questioning the views of, you know, the administration in terms of racial equality, et cetera. I think it's fair to at least question that. So I went in and thinking that there'd be some trauma, and they were fine. And I was like, I thought you guys would be, you know, a little upset maybe because, you know, there's been some questionable behavior in the past about, you know, racial attitudes. And they go, wait a second, are you telling us that there's a racist in the White House and you think that that's new for us? You think that it's new that we're hearing racist ideas from leadership? And they were like, pfft. And they just, it was a completely different experience of life. So I want to say something to RP, which is where I come from. We are definitely arguing as a country. And I believe that the universal, always shows up in the specific. So if you look at a relationship between a husband and a wife or a boyfriend and a girlfriend or a same-sex couple, and they're arguing, they're almost never arguing about what's really going on. Almost never. It's, I can't believe you're home late. And, well, I had to work. Well, you know, I've been here all day, you know, in the kitchen. And, well, I don't think you appreciate what I have to go. So that's not real, what's really going on. One person is saying, I don't feel seen and appreciated. And the other person is saying, you don't realize I was raised in a culture that all my value comes from my work. So I've never known it to exist in a relationship. It's just always been through my work. And when they start talking like that, you can feel the pressure and the tension leave, and they start talking to each other rather than at each other. Our country is talking at each other. They're not really talking about what's going on. I can't believe you're wearing a mask. I can't believe you're not wearing a mask. It's not the real conversation. It's is what is it that that mask indicates to you? Does it feel like you're being controlled because you've been controlled before and you feel your life has been a series of moments where you haven't had any agency? Because I can understand that. And then it shows up, I don't want to be told to wear a mask. I doubt that anyone not wearing a mask really wants to hurt another person. And that's where the healing is going to come. Look, if you look at South Africa, it came with the truth and reconciliation. We got to have a truth and reconciliation big time, where we all say what we're really feeling, and then we can get to the bridge, which is, I think we kind of want the same things. Tom, RP, a question, or both of you. Am I the only one who's seeing that the paradigm is busted? Like, that's why I think, Tom, you always think of me as an outlier. I'm seeing the paradigm is busted, right? And every now and then we have a really great saint or sage to come say, guys, the paradigm is busted. Like, I'm going to put it in terms of moral language, which is, I want you to love each other. I want you to treat each other like brothers and sisters, right? And is this being seen at all? Because it feels like, again, a fish has left the water and the other fish don't have any acknowledgement that there may be something else out there besides this water.
No, you're not even close to the only person who says the paradigm is busted. Trying to enter a hugely universal conversation quickly. I think if you were to go look at Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, so let's picture a bunch of white male billionaires, and most of the billionaires are white males. with only a couple exceptions, they all have come out and said, the system is completely broken and there's a huge part of America that's forgotten. I'm picking billionaires for a reason here. Not that they matter. They're not saints. You know, they matter, but not that their opinion is worth more than someone else's. All of them have come out, and I think almost without exception, right? From Ray Dalio to Bill Gates, to some extent to Bezos, certainly to Jeff Skoll, not Elon Musk, but he's a little different of a character right now. They all have sort of come out and said, the system is profoundly broken, and there's a huge amount of people that are way left behind that are being, whatever you word, fill in your verb, subjugated, victimized, whatever, right? So, well-known fact. You made a great point before. I come from a culture where my worth is defined by my job, my professional creation, whatever you want to call that. And we do live in that culture. And you made a point previously about this human animal today, kind of semi-unique, certainly semi-unique amongst other species, and almost to some extent new in the history of humanity. There's this human animal now that's like, I'm going to get all I can while the getting's good for me. And that it hadn't always been that way. Of course, it's been that way through different humans forever, you know, Genghis Khan or however you want to talk about it. But it's a little more of an accepted concept now. Like, greed is more accepted and allowed in American elite cycles than it ever was before. That's a fact. And you can look at statistics about that. And you can look at the difference of pay scale. One way to measure it is the difference of the pay scale from the CEO to the middle manager to the shop floor worker to the guy who washes the floors. And you can look at the difference in pay scale from history to now. And it's just the delta in between is just growing. So you're now at 300 times salary for the CEO over the middle manager, and then another 300 off of the shop floor worker, whatever it is. He's humongous gap. So that's a fact. And it's divisive. And everyone sort of sees it. I don't think anyone has any idea how to change it. That's not true at all. Actually, that's not true at all. Sorry. So Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have been very vocal about this, and they propose a lot of ideas they claim would change it. I'm not able right now to tell you if those are the right solutions or not. And then you get in this debate about, well, hey, you know, the great Winston Churchill quote, capitalism is the worst system in the world. I always blow my Churchill quotes. Sorry. And I can do them when I'm not recording. Except for all the rest. It's the worst system in the world, except for all the rest. But that's where we are. So Tom Shadyac, we are signed up right now for a greed-filled hyper-capitalist world for sure. But we have a number of leaders trying to change it. I would say on a hopeful note that we are very, very clearly accelerating away from that. How can I possibly say that in the midst of this pandemic? how could I possibly say that in the midst of so many people being so unevenly crushed by this versus others, right? So, you know, we're all in this, all in this together. We're not. That's bullshit. Sorry. The virus will kill us all indiscriminately. We're not all in this together, right? It's a horror. Some people's boats are sinking. Some people are not. So we're not all in this together. And but so how could I possibly say there's a positive outcome here so far as your question about this universal societal imbalance? Because we're accelerating the movement towards universal basic income. We're accelerating the movement toward, we are, I don't care who the next president is. We are becoming on the scale more and more socialist over time because of a variety of realizations and possibly this virus and what we're learning about others. Possibly that will spark the more real human interest in all of us. And I subscribe to the idea that the vast majority of us are very good people and we will want to begin to level the playing fields a little more, a little more, a little more. And you saw, and then statistically, why I have any confidence, you can look at the success of obviously the left candidates I mentioned earlier, but also even of Trump. So to some extent, Trump's political success is a indication that a lot of people, largely white, blue-collar workers, are saying the system is rigged against me. I want to change the system. They were completely foolish to believe Donald Trump would help them because he hasn't, but that was part of their belief. So meaning there's a lot of voters out there on the Bernie, AOC, Elizabeth Warren side, and some of the Trump voters who are saying we have to fix this system so that it's not rigged against the working person, even on the red state sides. Sorry again, Atristis. I tried to be short. I couldn't.
I mean, what do I secretly think about when I lie in bed at night is that I think you're largely right, Tom. And I'm just enough a coward to not want to be up for the fight. Because the paradigm you're talking about is way off. Now, it's not the first time this has happened. This happens a lot in humanity. We get off all the time. You know, we get way off track. And so, you know, I've read Ayn Rand. There's a lot about Ayn Rand that I believe, that I think is makes a lot of sense. But I've also read the Old Testament. You know, I've read the New Testament. I've read Robert Persig. I've read Noam Chomsky. Like, I read lots of different things. I like to read all sides of the equation, all sides of the story. And if there's something I've learned in my life is that to be reductive is to waste your time. Like, it feels good. Like, oh, I figured it out. I'm good now. And it makes you feel good because now, like, you can go about your life. Turns out it doesn't work that way. These things are very complex and so simple. Those two things actually go together. I'm always in this conversation. It's so complex and it's so simple. You know, and in the end, love is like this incredibly, incredibly powerful force. Like, love is the answer. Sounds such so stupid. It sounds so corny. It's like such a waste of time in a certain sense. But the power of love is insane. It's incredible what the power of love is. I'm being literal. The power that love creates is so, so strong. And I believe in it. I really believe in it. Unfortunately, there's times where I think like a pragmatist in a way I wish I didn't, because there, you know, there's a straighter path. Like, I'll take that path that is somehow polluted just because it's efficient and it's something that can actually be punched through. So to me, and if I were going to define the problem with the paradigm to me, to Tom, consumerism is right at the top, and consumerism is pretty universally held. Like, all parts of our culture, not everyone, of course, really is into consumerism. Like, we really need more things. It's the thing we're addicted to. It's that thing we care about most. It's that thing that makes the rich rich, right? That's how it works. I don't think anyone's sitting in rooms doing this all the time. I think it is something we came to believe in that helped us win a world war, helped us do a variety, helped us maintain freedoms. I actually believe all that. Yeah, but too much of anything, you sort of end up in a place that ends up being very, very destructive. So, and I think the place where we are now, you know, if you look at, like, you know, Persig, let's say, it's once we got past the food, shelter, you know, clothing stuff, well, then it just turns into this big mess. And that's where we live, generally speaking. And this isn't, you know, and I think it's ultimately, it kind of has to be destructive. I'm going to use an analogy. I hope it holds. Michael Jackson is as talented a person as there ever was. Like, you watch that guy and he is just magic. And Michael Jackson reached a point in his life where he couldn't go to McDonald's Like, you can't be Michael Jackson and Joy McDonald's. You can't be Michael Jackson, right? And he becomes odd. Like, he became a very odd thing, an odd being. I'm not trying to judge the guy, but I look at him and I think, like, that's what crazy success and praise looks like. There's a part of that that exists in our country. Is it a paradigm? I think it has to be. I would argue the paradigm is more of us, which is to say it's our values. It's our approach to love. It's certainly in part the systems, the way the government works, the way these other things work. But unfortunately for me, I view it as more of a cultural problem than it is the setup problem. But to, you know, my long-winded answer is we definitely have a paradigm problem. Like, we definitely have a paradigm problem. What the answer is, how much I can hope for perfection, different set of questions. I don't have the answers to those things. I have hopes for those things. But that would be my observation.
I think you're the answer. I do. I think you're the answer.
I think that's right. I think that's right, Tom. I was going to say a similar thing. Not me. TMP, Tom. Yep.
Yeah. Because you're considering, you're nobody's ever going to, quote, get it right. There is no, quote, right. There's just conditions that beget more life. That's what I like to look at. It's a Paul Hawkins saying, look for the conditions that beget more life, because all of life wants to beget more life, more experience, more diversity. So a couple things in summation. Number one, we didn't always behave this way because we didn't have the ability to behave this way. There's about 96% of the human species that were in the indigenous cultures that couldn't store things. So they knew inherently that they needed each other and they needed nature. But once, due to our creativity and our evolution, we got this storage system in place where we could freeze things and take land and specialize, greed started to come into our equation in a much stronger way than it had ever done in the indigenous cultures. So again, this is not a philosophy that, you know, native populations had no challenges and no moral challenges. But the one that came into us after storage systems, right? That's why the philosophers say don't even store into barns, right? What thing in nature stores like we store? Nothing, right? What thing in nature takes like we take? Cancer, right? That just keeps growing and sees growth as a god. So it wasn't always like this. And it would do us well to look back at the indigenous populations that were in touch with nature and the earth and see what some of those ideas were that propelled their societies forward. So that's number one. I just want to establish that. Our way, history did not start when we could pick up a pen and write history. It started 200,000 years ago, and that's arguable to a million years, depending on what we call humanity. So I want to argue for myself as to why I'm optimistic, so optimistic, because I think, RP, I think you said this, that like it's happening, and it may be happening to a point that we're not even aware that it's happening, because it's already written in the design, and I'll tell you why. I got a choice. I can go back to being someone that a typical artist, which is I get as much money from a movie, and then I just buy stuff for myself and give a little away, but I take care of my own and my certain circle of compassion. Or I can continue this life with, I see art as a service industry. I see all industries as service industries in their highest iterations, meaning I take care of myself, whatever I need to be the unique human I am, pursue any passion. I love bicycles. I got expensive bicycles. But whatever I don't need, the remainder is needed by others. Whatever energy comes my way, be it a talent or a resource. So I serve with that energy. Guess which way? It's already written that I don't choose this, because it's not a choice. It is so compelling and so undeniably strong. The power of love, as you said, Tom, which is meeting Chris and falling in love with Chris and falling in love with Jaman and falling in love with a new story that has such resiliency and such power and soul. There's no going back.
Breaking Tom Scott's rule about being reductivist. Listening to what you just said, Shadyac, if you go to service is selfish because service makes you feel good, right? So like, you know, if we really are just wet computers looking for dopamine, serotonin hits, which unfortunately we probably are. It's wildly reductivist. That's what my point is. Then service can be a real winning solution, right? It just feels great, right? Like when I get a message from someone who watches this little show we're doing and they say it helped with this or that, like that's the highlight of, you know, my non-child-centered day. Like I love that. That's a you know, serotonin boost for me. So if there's, you know, thank God it feels great. You know, thank God Stacy from yesterday feels fired up to get out there and help people. And thank God that the people who work with you, Tom Shadyac, feel excited to get out there and help people. Like it feels good. If it feels good, hopefully we'll do more of it. So maybe part of what we can do is help people realize how great it feels so they can get out there and be other-centered and try to get more of a life of service.
All right, two things about that, because it's true. It's in the design for a reason that it feels good. The design, the universal intelligence, whatever it is that created all this, could have said, hey, you know what? I'm going to make it feel great to hate and to murder. But it doesn't. It breaks down our biology. Like it, all those, you know, the state of flow is never in a state of hate. It's always in
that's a great point.
In a positive idea, right? So it's in the design for a reason. And I would argue that that selfish thing that we call selfish is an illusion in this sense. There really is no you without me. Like if you look at the quantum analysis, the quantum physical analysis, there's no end to me and beginning of you. It's all the same energy looking at each other through different iterations. So the little self is always connected with the higher self. And it's there for a reason. And that's why I believe it's coming. And if not through our species, we'll go away. Something else will be born that understands that idea.
Well, let's hope it's not that long.
So yesterday I was on the phone with Richard Saulwerman. Richard Saulwerman, if you don't know, is the founder of the TED Conference. He's 85. He's had a really interesting career, and he's a fascinating guy. He's a grouchy guy. He's more into, I hope he would agree with this. He's more into the, he has traditionally been more into the head side of sort of what we do at the Nantucket Project, which is the TED side, generally technology, design types of things, than the heart side of sort of what we do. That's who he's been. And he's, you know, because of who he is, he's super up to date on the disease, and he studies it all day, and he's, you know, he's very up on how it works and where it's going and all these other questions. But he said to me, he said, you know, as an 85-year-old, basically he's been very focused on more. And a lot of the, like some of the best work he's done has been about an access to more. And he, you know, the way he said it and the tone of his voice, he said, it has to be better now. We have to do this better. He's not the kind of guy who falls into these like temporary, you know, emotional epiphanies. He's very like, he's very thoughtful in the way he thinks about the things he does. And by the way, he calls himself selfish. He calls himself lots of things. He's not like the kind of guy who's trying to like show off to me in that way, in his love of others way. But it was really a moment where I was listening to what he was saying, and I thought, my God, I never thought I'd hear him say this. Anyway, it was just a little piece of news, because as I'm hearing you guys talk and hearing the different things that you're reacting to, and hearing you, Tom, say that sort of once your father and Danny Thomas went in the direction of founding this thing, there was kind of no going the other way. You know, maybe we are at the beginning of a new way of thinking about certain things that that we can be hopeful about. We've been very philosophical today, and I've enjoyed that. I mean, I think it's a healthy part of what we're doing here. I just thought right before we go, RP, if there's like a headline or two overnight that you see, is it valuable to mention? If you don't, you don't. And I know you got a lot going on.
But, I'll do one quickly. And it actually ties in. And I also, at some point, Tom, I know you've studied much more philosophy than I ever have. I'd love to have a conversation, and maybe our viewers would hate it, but I'd love to talk about, you know, mimetic theory and Rene Girard and how it ties in what we've discussed today. And I'd like to learn from the two of you about that, because I bet you have a lot of thoughts on that. Headlines. So I think it ties into also what we talked about today, right? So leadership. One thing that I think we have to keep emphasizing for everybody is while historically we can look to others to lead us right now, we have to lead for ourselves right now. And if you make a little small mistake, you can become a super spreader of the disease. People you care about can die because you spread it to them. Fact. And there's many places in this country where the disease isn't really around, and it's crazy to wonder why your businesses are closed. Also a fact. I get it. The headline today is that Dr. Anthony Fauci, yesterday in testimony to the Senate, disagreed pretty sharply with what we've been hearing from the president about the status of the disease. And that Dr. Fauci was attacked is a strong word, but let's say, like, they went after Fauci a little bit, and Senator Paul Rand, is that his name? Why am I in trouble with that? Rand, right?
Rand Paul.
Rand Paul, thanks. Rand Paul came after him. I was thinking Ayn Rand, right? Would make a little sense. So Ron, I bet you that's what he was named after. But Rand Paul went after Fauci and said, you know, you're not the be-all. You're not the be-all end-all is what he meant. You're not the be-all of this whole thing. You don't have all the answers. Like, ouch, all right. He said, you're right. I'm not. I'm the epidemiologist, and I'm telling you what I think the best science tells us. And I'm not the economist, and I'm not telling you what the best economic theory is. So that debate happened. And what Redfield and Fauci both said was, you know, as the doctors, as you reopen, we're going to take some hits. And if we can wear masks, and if we can stick with the social distancing and the hand washing, those hits will be decreased. But in the fall, this disease is going to come back strong. So that was one news item. The second one from that testimony was there will not be a vaccine in time to open schools. Third news item is University of California has decided to close the UC system, the California State system, for the fall. It's another big news item. So there was a lot of news. We've talked a lot about the criticality of schools. And then I guess the final thing from the testimony was Dr. Fauci said, he used the word cavalier. Let's not be too cavalier about the health effects here. We don't know enough about the virus. Let's not be cavalier about the health effects on children. We're not quite sure yet. And he referred to the Kawasaki-like virus or the Kawasaki-like syndromes that are happening largely amongst New York State children who are being treated for coronary dilation issues, meaning really bad shit with your heart because of this disease. And so those are news items. Those are all pretty negative pieces of news, but they're very much in keeping with what we've talked about. And, you know, the solution for all of us is got to be your own leader. There's a debate amongst our best leadership, our best, our senators, our executive branch, our top doctors about what you ought to do. So you need to learn for yourself. You need to protect yourself. And try to figure out where the real news is, because we're not getting a unified message from the top. Footnote, guess what? There's not a single epidemic where there was a really strong unified message. This is not unusual. It's going back to the Black Death, the plague, the 1917-18 Spanish flu, the HIV pandemic. There's always voices of division, and it's always the individual who dies. So be your own leader.
RP, that California news, are they doing distance learning? Is that what you're saying? Are they actually shutting down?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, distance learning. I apologize. Yes, 100% distance learning. It's the fourth largest educational block in America. So yeah, it must be all the UC schools are not going to have a fall semester in person. They're going to do it as much as they can by distance.
Wow. That's a big news.
It's big news.
Okay. Well, RP, I want to... I don't think I've given you your due in a while. I want to thank you because I get a lot of notes, and I think it's really important that you're able to sort of give people, you know, the kind of information that you give it with the heart that goes along with it. It makes such a big difference. So thanks for doing that. And Tom, I'll look at your face, your real face. Thank you so much. I mean, I'm not leaving Memphis yet, but I'm so impressed and I'm so happy. I'm happy for you and I'm happy for the people around here. It's a tough time. It's a tough time. But when you observe the level of spirit, you know, that's what more could you hope for in life. So thank you so much.
Tom Scott, thank you very much for that. And Tom Shadyac, I will say, when I saw your opening evocation for the last TMP thing, I did think you're a little bit out there, I was like, wow, this guy's going right for kind of universal truths and deep heart stuff right off the bat. And I mean, it was beautiful, but I was like, oof, you know, I couldn't get my hands on it, you know, just the beginning of that thing. And now having spent, and then a bunch of my pals who watched that came back and said, that was awesome, inspiring and touching. So I realized I had to watch a little more closely. And now that I got the privilege of spending these, you know, this hour with you, hour plus, it's been a real honor and a real education. So thank you.
Well, let me say the same for you. We each lead with different parts of our kind of strongest personality traits. I'm what you call in the Enneagram a four, which means I'm an artist. I'm always looking at the opposite. Fours need threes. And I don't know if you're a three, but I know that you know things and you can organize things and you know systems and you know structures and histories. And man, we need your kind in the world. And listening to your last summation was worth the price of admission. So thank you.
This is
okay, guys.
Thank you. All right, buddy. Take care.
Bye.
Don't fall off that wall, Tom Scott. I know you're going to try to climb that thing.